And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to a midweek classic replay edition of the show with me, Justin Brierley. Today, a classic debate between Stephen Meyer and Keith Fox on what was Stephen Meyer's recently released book, Signature in the Cell. Stephen, a leading ID proponent, of course, and a Signature in the Cell, a classic book which claims to show that the DNA code is the product of an intelligent mind, not just naturalistic processes. Well, Keith Fox, professor of biochemistry at the time at Southampton University and chair of the UK Christian in Science Network, came on to debate this. He disagrees strongly with intelligent design, and they debated how life could have originated and whether design is allowable as an explanation in science in this show that was first broadcast in November 2011. Hope you enjoy it. Let's first of all get an introduction to yourself, Stephen. First time you've joined me in person on the programme.
Right.
But we did have you on, getting on for a year and a half ago now, with Peter Atkins.
Peter Atkins by phone, yes.
which was an interesting interaction. I'll post a link to that with alongside this programme. Keith, we've had you on as well a couple of times before, and it's great to see you back here in the studio.
Pleasure to be back here again.
Thank you for coming back. Stephen, your name is synonymous, really, with intelligent design. But tell us a little bit of background yourself. How did you come into this whole area in the first place?
Well, I was working as an industry scientist. I was in the field of geophysics and doing what was called digital signal processing, seismic sections for an oil company back in the mid-1980s as a young scientist. And a conference came to the city where I was working on the big questions that intersect science and philosophy, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the question of the origin and nature of consciousness. And I had double majored in science as an undergraduate, but I always snuck across campus to take philosophy classes as well. So I found the topic of the conference irresistible. And I was especially fascinated by the panel on the origin of life. I had pretty much learned that the evolutionary biologist had all such questions all sewn up, and was shocked to find that really leading people in origin of life studies were quite candid about their inability to explain the origin of the first life. And I became fascinated with the topic, and a year later was off to Cambridge for an MPhil year that then mutated into a PhD. And I did my PhD work on the topic of the origin of life, both examining the scientific aspects of the controversy, but also the historical and philosophical, in particular the methodology by which scientists study events in the remote past.
Now, when you say the origin of life, for those who may not exactly be sure of what you mean by that, you're talking there about how did the very first biologically complex sort of organism arise in that
exactly,
sense.
The origin of the very first life. Many people don't realize that this is a question that Darwin didn't address in The Origin of Species. He wrote one letter in which he speculated perhaps about life beginning in a warm little pond of some various combinations of chemicals, but this was not something that he addressed in the late 19th century. It wasn't until the 1920s and 30s that a formal, undirected chemical evolutionary theory of the origin of life was formulated by a Russian scientist named Oparin. And That theory had some traction for a time, but in the wake of the molecular biological revolution in the 1950s and 60s, the whole field really fell into disarray, or a kind of a state of impasse where people recognized the severity of the problem of accounting for a self-replicating, information-rich system that we now call the cell, but no one really had credible or plausible explanations of how that would have arisen. And that was the problem that I took on in the...
And indeed, it sort of culminates now in your book, Signature in the Cell, which is a massive volume. It looks quite daunting, but reading it, it actually kind of, I think, is aimed probably at a lay audience in terms of... you obviously, there's a lot of science in there, but you're trying to bring it across in terms of almost a detective hunt, almost, is the way I see it.
Well, I set it up as kind of a scientific mystery story.
Yeah.
I begin the book by talking about what I call the DNA enigma.
Mm.
The DNA enigma is not the structure of the DNA molecule. Watson and Crick did a great job of elucidating that. It's not really what DNA does. We know that it stores digital information that directs the synthesis of proteins. But the enigma is, where did the information come from? And what I do is examine the progressive attempts that have been made to solve that mystery over now almost 80 years, and show that why each one has failed and why each one has come to the same essential problem. The insoluble problem is not necessarily just the prebiotic chemistry. How did we get these building blocks to form? Although that turns out to be a very difficult problem itself, but it's rather, how do you get those building blocks to arrange themselves into the information-rich codes that are necessary to produce living systems?
Absolutely, and this is the core of the book. This is the search that's been on, as it were, for, is there a naturalistic explanation for the origin of life? Your claim in the book is that the best explanation is intelligent design. Well, we're obviously going to come to that. One thing that struck me as interesting is on the front of this, which I assume is the UK edition I have here, a Times Literary Supplement Book of the Year. And looking into that, I think it was it the philosopher Thomas Nagel who
right, he's
who
actually
recommended
interestingly
it?
An atheistic philosopher from
I was going to say it didn't seem like the first obvious person to sort of recommend this as a Times Book of the Year. So what was his sort of angle on that? Why was he interested in the subject?
Well, I'm not sure the nature of his interest, but he's a very deep and profound philosopher of science, and I think he said that it presented a fiendishly difficult problem in a very careful way. And okay. So I appreciated those words, obviously, and was kind of surprised to have received the honor, such as it
out
was.
Of the blue,
poor Nagel, though, received quite a lot of abusive correspondence in the Times Literary Supplement afterwards.
Well, I mean, this in a sense raises the whole issue of the fact that intelligent design is such a divisive issue. It is such a hot potato, if you like. And I have to say, I'm very glad that Keith's here, but I did look into a number of potential people who might come on, and it was very difficult to find people who it's almost that intelligent design is seen as very tricky, very divisive. A lot of people, it's almost just
radioactive,
swear word,
yes,
something like that. But what?
Well, can I speak to that for a minute?
Yeah, dude. Tell us, why is it so really, controversial?
In some ways, I can say why. There's a lot of reasons why it might be seen as radioactive and difficult. My point that I'd like to make is just that I don't think it should be. There are two basic positions on this issue. And this goes back. Steve Fuller, the philosopher of science from Warwick, has made the point that the question of design or apparent design is the animating question of British natural philosophy, going back to Boyle and Newton and all the way through Faraday and Maxwell and Darwin himself. And Dawkins, I know he's a controversial figure and maybe not regarded as the serious figure he once was. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate him because I think he does a very good job of defining the key issue. And in the first page of The Blind Watchmaker, he says that biology, this is the Darwinian perspective, the classical Darwinian perspective, that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And in Dawkins's view, obviously, the key word in that statement is appearance. Mm. Design is an illusion. It's a powerful illusion, a suggestive illusion, but it's an illusion nonetheless. And it's an illusion because the Darwinian view is that there is a purely undirected, unguided process natural selection acting on random mutations that can produce the appearance of design without having been designed by an actual guiding intelligence. Natural selection then functions as a kind of designer substitute in in the Darwinian view. And what I that's one view. The opposite view is that life looks designed because it is in some sense actually designed. There is a designing intelligence behind it. And what I do in the book is take on that question of design or apparent design. And ask if, you know, the legacy of Darwin, and there's been a lot of discussion of this since the 200th anniversary in 2009, the legacy of Darwin, many intellectual historians and evolutionary biologists tell us, is that he refuted the design argument. And I ask the question, well, is that really true? And I zero in on the question of the origin of life because whatever one's view of biological evolution is, I have to be skeptical about some of the most significant aspects of it, the ability of mutation and selection to produce, for example, whole new body plans. But setting that aside, at least for the sake of argument, it's abundantly clear that Darwin did not account for the origin of the first life, and no one since Darwin has been able to account for that either in purely undirected materialistic terms.
And so, as you point out in the book, Darwin simply was not in possession of the vast range of biological
Darwin. So the question, but the claim that Darwin refuted design and biology, the very staunch claims that Richard Dawkins makes about design having been repudiated and that biology is just the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose, I think can't be justified. On its face, there's at least one area where we have no materialistic account of the appearance of design. And even in the simplest cell, there are very striking appearances of design, the most important of which is, I think, the digital code and the whole information processing system, which is the focus of my book.
I just want to come to you now, Keith. Keith, you are Professor of Biochemistry, University of Southampton, and DNA is your thing. You've been studying this for years.
It is indeed,
And so, but you obviously come to very different conclusions.
Yeah, and I think we need to be clear at the outset that we're actually conflating two different issues here. One is the origin of life, which Darwin may have speculated on, but really had no idea at all, and for which there are still plenty of speculations, but we can't be sure, and Darwinian evolution, which is a different item altogether. That's how life evolves once it is started.
Once you've got that starting
point, we need
to
be clear there are two different issues at stake here. As far as I understand it, intelligent design, well, it's a broad church, and some would question the origin of life and then allow for evolution as a process through.
Right, there are many
and
there
others
are many
would
different
take a different view and say that actually the whole of Darwinian evolution is flawed.
Or parts of it are flawed. There are many different design hypotheses. I mean, one area where there's a lot of interest in design that doesn't even have anything to do with biology is the whole issue of the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics from the very beginning of the universe. So there would be advocates of intelligent design who would see design at that locus in cosmic history at the beginning of the universe. There would be others, like myself, who would see evidence of design at the point of the origin of the first life. And there would be still others who would see evidence of intelligent design later down the timeline in events like the Cambrian explosion or something.
And that's why I think we need to unpick
absolutely
those issues.
And
it comes
very,
back
very
partly
helpful,
to why
actually,
why some people are reluctant to debate the issue because it's seen in some ways as contaminated by the whole young Earth issue. It's seen as being, for many scientists, unscientific or irrelevant. The question of whether it is designed or not, things do appear designed, and are we just arguing a tautology?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I think we need to be clear on here is that what the book is about specifically is the origin of life and that mystery at the very heart of this thing. And I'd be interested to know, because, and I'll again post some links to the shows you've done with us, Keith, as well, which have been more on the aspects of evolutionary biology once life has begun, as it were. But where do you stand on this issue of the origin of life? Is it something we should be agnostic on? Do you think there is a naturalistic explanation? Are you open in any sense to design?
I actually want to come back further and ask the question of what do we mean by naturalistic explanation for two Christians talking together. I mean, God is over the whole of nature. Now, without him, nothing was made that has been made. So to talk about naturalistic or non-naturalistic, actually for two Christians debating, I think is an irrelevance because everything is natural and everything is material and everything is designated as good by God, who's involved in that material world. Now, the question is actually, I suppose, was there a divine intervention against those, if you like, natural, and I use the word now, processes that God interfered, if you like, with his own processes, so as to ensure the development of that life, or was there not? Now, we don't, as scientists, know, have a cast-iron view of how life emerged, that first self-replicating system. There's some very good ideas, and those ideas have developed, particularly over the last 10 years, even since Stephen's book, particularly the RNA world hypothesis. It may be right, it may be wrong, but that's the nature of science, is to put hypotheses down, to test them, see are they feasible, come up with new hypotheses. So I don't think it's that science is putting its hands up and say we don't have a clue. We have a number of clues. It may be 10 years' time we'll have different clues. But the nature of science is to ask questions and to say, how did this happen, rather than just to put our hands up and say, we'll never know.
I mean, is that what you're doing effectively?
That's very much not what I'm doing. I think one of the interesting parts of the way this investigation folded for me was the realization that the origin of life, and particularly the origin of the information that is necessary to make life function, is a very deep and profound mystery. I have an extensive chapter in the book on the RNA world, and it's I think quite up to date. The RNA world has really come to a state of impasse itself, because even to get a self-replicating molecule going, the experiments that we've done have shown that even limited replicase capacity requires a great deal of specified information.
Before we go too much further, for those who are uninitiated, RNA is what? What does it do in the cell? What's its part?
Could I punt on that and get to the main point first, and then come back to the technical
point?
Please
do. Okay.
The point about though is that there are these series of attempts to solve this problem of the origin of information, and people working in the field of origin of life biochemistry have been quite frank about their inability to do so. And the information problem is the fundamental problem that has caused each of these approaches to come to impasse. I came to a point in my own investigation where I began to wonder if there was another approach that could be investigated, which is the idea of intelligent design. And I asked myself a question: is it possible to formulate a rigorous scientific case for intelligent design? And as I was studying this, I was studying the works of Darwin and the logic of the argument in the Origin of Species and the method that he pioneered for studying events in the remote past. And I realized that he used a method that was called the method of multiple competing hypotheses, or the method of inferring to the best explanation. And that raises the question, well, what constitutes a best explanation? And his mentor, Charles Lyell, was very clear on this, that when we're trying to explain an event in the remote past, we're looking for, as he put it, causes now in operation, causes that are known to produce the effect in question. Darwin called it the vera causa criterion, true causes, causes that are known to produce the effect in question. And as I began to reflect on that, I realized that it was very possible to formulate a scientific case for intelligent design as a best explanation, precisely because of what we know about the type of cause that produces information. Based on our experiences, an information scientist who was, at the same time I was investigating this, named Henry Quassler, and he observed that the creation of information is habitually associated with conscious activity. This is something we know from our uniform and repeated experience, which is the basis of all scientific reasoning, and as Darwin and Lyell pointed out, the basis of all scientific reasoning about the past. And so what we know from experience is that it takes a mind to generate information. What we're looking at in DNA is precisely information in a specified digital form. And so based on our knowledge of cause and effect, it becomes possible to infer intelligence as a causal explanation, and in fact, the best causal explanation because of the absence of others that are sufficient.
See, I would take issue with that there, in terms of saying that you need a mind in order to get information. Yes, you need to get a mind to have some of the forms of information that we construct with our own minds. But one thing to my mind, it looked as though it was absent from the book, was the whole question of random mutation plus natural selection, which is the way that an evolutionary biologist, a biochemist, a geneticist would explain how information arises. So it's not random. It's not all there all at once. This is a process that develops over time through natural selection.
Well, but in the case of the origin of life, and I very clearly make this demarcation, when we're talking about the origin of the first life, we can't invoke natural selection and random mutation, we don't yet have a self-replicating system that can generate information in that fashion.
That is true, but you started your argument by talking about Darwin, who was talking about evolution and how life developed, not the origin of life.
But I'm not conflating those two things. I very carefully distinguish the two and make clear that the book is about the origin of information, and the principle that I'm espousing based on uniform experience is that if we're starting from a purely chemical and physical system, there is no known process that generates information. Now, it may be that mutation and selection can generate enough information to drive biological evolution. I think that is itself a contestable proposition, but it's not one I contest in this book. And instead, I very clearly make the point that if we're talking about purely physical chemical antecedents, we have knowledge of no process that generates the kind of specified digital information that we find in the living system. And that from that starting point, mind is the only thing that moves us from matter to informational arrangements.
I'll come back to you in a moment, Keith. I mean, for those who are not familiar with the book, I mean, anyone, wherever you fall on this argument, will be amazed at the incredible complexity of the cell of DNA. It's just it's mind-boggling, really. And what you draw out is just how, on your view, chance or necessity cannot be the cause of this incredibly complex DNA code.
It's a fascinating, it's a wonderful thing. I think Keith and I can agree on this. I mean, when you look at the information processing system at work in the cell, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. You've got digital code stored in the DNA molecule, and then you have this whole complex network of protein machines that are used to express that information, to process it. And the DNA is necessary to build the proteins. The proteins are necessary to read and express the information on DNA. It's a closed loop chicken or egg system. It's absolutely fascinating.
Maybe we can come back to that chicken or egg situation, but everything about the world is mind-boggling. So the cell is mind-boggling. The way in which the human body is constructed is mind-boggling. The way in which the whole of the environment that we live in, the ecosystems that we and the communities are, is mind-boggling. Everything is complex. So that's maybe why I take issue with, now why focus on the level of that tiny molecular structure as being complex and say, there goes God, rather than actually say, well, there's the human body, there goes God, or there we wouldn't do that with the human body.
In science, we look for problems that are tractable. And what we've done is we've picked out a critical feature of living systems. So the origin of life people themselves say that the fundamental issue is the origin of the information. I'd like to ask my students, if you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? Well, you've got to provide code. You've got to provide information. The same thing is true in living systems, it turns out. There's a great discovery of the late 20th century biology, is that you want to build a new form of life from a simpler pre-existing form, you need information. To get life going in the first place, you need information. Now, what do we know about the origin of information based on our uniform and repeated experience?
Except that computers don't self-replicate and they don't mutate in a way that still can allow survival. If a computer program mutates, it's dead, usually. Whereas with mutation plus natural selection, there's a different means in biology that's not there in that digital form.
When we're talking about the origin of life,
let's go back to that.
We need to kind of focus in on this.
We can't keep invoking mutation and selection when those processes are not yet operative until you have living systems.
I suppose it's that first DNA molecule and the fact that most people seem to agree the idea of it arising just by chance of all these elements coming together just doesn't make any sense because the odds are stacked so incredibly against that. So I would assume you'd agree that chance isn't a good explanation.
In terms of assembling a long DNA molecule, no. Meaning that the smallest viable bacterium is big. I mean, you're talking about millions of bases, the components of that. And the chance of that, just purely assembling as a complete unit, is negligible. So we're asking the question, what could have come before then as a replicating system that may not have been a cell, but some self-replicating molecule that then assembled over eons of time into something that was cellular.
One of the things I do show in the book, he's talking about the RNA world, and what the RNA world attempts to do is to put the level of the threshold at which you would get some kind of selective process as low as possible. Okay. Instead of having a self-replicating organism, it attempts to say, well, we could have started with a self-replicating molecule.
Okay.
But one of the results that I examine in the book is what we know about what it would take to get even a molecule capable of self-replication. Now, with extensive what's called ribozyme engineering, scientists have been able to produce a molecule that's capable of replicating about one-tenth of itself. But even that limited self-replicating capacity depends on a very high degree of what's called sequence specificity. You've got to get the RNA bases, the letters in the genetic text, arranged in precisely the right way, even to generate that limited self-replication, which shows that even before you get self-replication, you've got to have information. So even the RNA world idea that you could start with a self-replicating molecule presupposes but does not explain the necessary information to get that going. And that's what the argument's about. What does it take to get information? Again, I argue, based on our experience, we know of only one cause, and that's information. RNA world does not solve it. It presupposes the same problem.
But in science, the word is never say never. So if you'd have gone back 20 years, 25 years ago, there would have been that chicken and egg question. And we need DNA to make RNA. We need RNA to make protein. We need protein to replicate the DNA. So that's a vicious circle. Mm. Where do we break that? And it was the realization that RNA itself had catalytic activity, that itself could self-replicate, it can do plenty of enzymic reactions that are now done by proteins, that brought about the idea that maybe RNA was that precursor. Now, that was, if you like, a quiet revolution in biochemistry and molecular biology. And where are we going to be in 10 years, 20 years, 25 years' time?
We will come back to you, Stephen. We're going to have to take a quick break, though, just now. Really getting into the meat of this already, and so many more questions that arise. But you're listening to a programme here on Unbelievable, one of our more science-based programmes, as we look at the whole issue of intelligent design, asking, is there a signature in the cell? My guests today are Stephen Mayer and Keith Fox. We'll be back in just a moment's time. As I said earlier in the programme, you just mentioned the word intelligent design, and people have a lot of ideas about what that means. And one of the first things that people very often say to me when I mention it is, oh, yes, wasn't that shown to be non-scientific by a judge? Now, this is a big question. Can a judge tell us what counts as science or not? This refers to the Dover School Board versus Kitzmiller, some time back when there was a case involving, I think, whether a school board was allowed to use a certain book that advocated intelligent design, and that went to court in America, and the judge ruled that intelligent design was not scientific. Okay, we'll get your view on this, Keith, but where does the Discovery Institute stand on this whole issue?
Well, a couple things. There's some background. A lot of people don't realize that the leading proponents of intelligent design in America and the Discovery Institute institutionally opposed the action of the Dover School Board. It did so primarily on prudential grounds, which we saw this as a train wreck. You know, that it was coming. To take this question to the court, to politicize it, is you know, it was counterproductive. It was going to result in the stigmatization of the many scientists in universities in the United States and overseas who are interested and or proponents of intelligent design. And that's exactly what has happened. But as to the merits of the case, the policy was benighted. It was poorly framed. But the judge was also operating above his pay grade. The question of the nature and definition of science is a question of the philosophy of science. And we really don't look to federal judges to decide deep and imponderable questions about the definition of science. It was an attempt to settle the question by kind of judicial fiat.
The more fundamental question, though, is that it raised in people's awareness this idea that intelligent design is a Trojan horse, let's say, for creationism, for what Keith, you were talking about young earth creationism. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that the way you see it? Do you see that intelligent design is too wedded to a sort of literalistic interpretation of Genesis and all the rest of it?
I think intelligent design is a broad church. For some people, it clearly is a Trojan horse. It's like the acceptable face of young earth creationism that is sort of clothed in it. I'm not suggesting in any way that that's where Stephen's coming from.
But then if that's the case, you need to let those who are the proponents of the theory define what the theory is. Yeah. And this is what happened in Dover. People who were actually not proponents of the theory, they were young earth creationists, were using intelligent design to try to gain respectability for their biblically based understanding of Genesis. And intelligent design is not creationism for two key reasons. First, intelligent design is an inference from biological evidence, which uses the same method of scientific reasoning that Darwin himself championed in The Origin of Species. It's a scientific-based argument. Creationism is a deduction or an interpretation from scripture. Number two, intelligent design is not advocating a young earth or any other interpretation of the 6 days of the Genesis account. Its starting point is the scientific evidence, and it's attempting to make the best explanation of that evidence that it can using standard methods of scientific reasoning.
To come back to the Dover trial, it was somewhat unusual, I agree, that a judge should make a pronouncement on a scientific issue and the philosophy of science. Nonetheless, I'm not sure he was wide of the mark in his final pronouncement as to whether intelligent design was effectively just another God of the gaps type of explanation, and whether science can actually allow, within its own definitions, other than a rational explanation, actually to say that a God has stepped in and done something, it actually is a science stopper.
Well, this brings us neatly back into where we sort of left off in the last section, which is you just don't see, Keith, as far as I can see, design as having any helpful role in the pursuit of science and explanation, because you describe it as a science stopper, that we're giving up the chase early if we simply say, yeah, looks complex, designed.
For a Christian who knows the Creator, to look around and see where the world is, it's amazing. And you can use that word design in all sorts of contexts. But for the scientist to say it's designed and therefore I can't ask any more questions, so I think it is a science stopper. The scientist's nature is always to say, but how? But how? Give me an explanation. Mm-hmm. So it may well be that, for instance, give Stephen the benefit of the doubt, that God did design the first DNA molecule. The scientists will say, how? Mm. So was that by a miraculous process which said, zap, it's here? Or was there a chemical process that actually didn't break any of the laws of chemistry and physics and biology as we know them? In which case, that's an open for the scientists to explore.
Would it have had to...
There's a missing idea here, and it's what we know from experience about the power of agency. We have a monument in the United States, Mount Rushmore, where the faces of the presidents are carved into the mountain. Anyone who looks at that, because of what they know about the cause and effect structure of the world, will immediately realize that was the product of intelligence. It was not just wind and erosion that produced the faces on Mount Rushmore. Now, I'm not saying that there are little faces inside the cell, but I'm saying that there are other distinctive attributes of intelligent activity.
A
signature of intelligence, and that signature is information, as well as a number of other things.
But essentially what you're saying is that we're at a level where we don't understand.
No, I'm saying we do understand. I think you've been affected by the surrounding materialistic zeitgeist of science, which says that unless it's a materialistic explanation, it's not an explanation. And what we're saying is that the making reference to the activity of mind can be explanatory, because we know that minds have causal powers. They can do things, and there are specific kinds of things that minds do that we can pick out and recognize from their effects. And information is one of the things that invariably leads us back to the activity of mind. And when we see information in the cell, we can justifiably infer that a mind acted.
You see, you've used a loaded word within that. You'd use the word material, which is for many people like a red rag to a bull, because we talk about materialism. But the science is the explanation of the material in terms of its properties. Now, a Christian would say that God is intimately involved in the material and he upholds the whole universe all the time. But does that necessarily mean that he's interfering with the material or creating new material all the time? And that's where I come back to natural selection.
We don't think of the action of an agent, whether it be God or someone else, as violating the laws of nature. The laws of nature tell you what ordinarily happens. C.S. Lewis had an excellent essay on this. It tells you what ordinarily happens, provided there's no interference. If an agent acts, if I lift up the book off the table, I'm not violating the law of gravity. I'm initiating a new law of causation or a new line of causation within the matrix of natural law. If you look at the words on the printed page there in front of you, Justin has a copy of my book open. And you say, well, what caused those words to originate? If we only talk about the chemistry and physics of the ink on the paper, we're missing an important aspect of the cause that produced those words, which was, in this case, a semi-intelligent designer named me.
I mean, this kind of gets to the nub of it, doesn't it? Which is design a valid inference to the best explanation? I mean, you make a lot of this in the book, don't you?
People's minds to the whole of reality. The activity of mind acting on nature is part of reality. And the narrow definition of science that says that it's only a scientific explanation if you refer to a materialistic or naturalistic or physical cause is missing an important aspect of reality. And intelligent design is saying, mind is real, mind
isn't
real causal
saying
powers, and we can detect the activity.
His real problem with it is that it kind of puts off the hunt. It says, once you've sort of decided it was intelligent mind, you've kind of stopped asking any more questions.
That happens if you decide that it's mutation and selection. You've answered a scientific question. You can just as easily say, well, that's a science stopper. There's a basic question on the table. Is the appearance of design more likely to be the product of undirected processes, and therefore is it merely apparent? Or is the appearance of design real? Is it the result of an actual designing intelligence? There's one issue, two possible answers. I don't see how answering the question in one way makes science any more comes to a halt than in the other way. I think it's
But you're trying to impose on your science something to do with meaning and purpose, which is not where science is going.
No, that's not what
we're
doing. We're simply inferring the cause that is known from our experience to produce the effect in question, rather than causes that are not known from our experience to produce the effect in question.
But the scientists will still come back and ask the question, but how? So that there may be a, and the question
well, well, how is a surrogate for the issue of causality? And our point is that agency, mind, conscious activity can be causal, and therefore it is an answer to the how question.
But the how question, if you like, chemically, is how did those molecules assemble?
In a sense, that's what science wants to get to, is the how. Now, you're not giving a how, you're giving an explanation.
We're
in terms
of causal explanation.
A causal explanation, yes. Which appears to be valid in other branches of science. We all the time infer.
We detect the activity of mind in cryptography, in insurance fraud detection, in forensics, in archaeology. Imagine Keith making the same argument to an archaeologist who inferred from an inscription, say the Rosetta Stone, and inferred that there had been a scribe. Well, that's a scribe of the gaps argument, we would say. Well, no, this is not an argument from ignorance. It's an argument from what we know about the cause and effect structure.
But isn't Keith saying even if you inferred design, You'd still ask the question, well, how then?
There's still chemistry and physics behind the whole process.
Would it be literally if you went somehow with a microscope to that first self-replicating molecule that you'd see all the bits suddenly moving together, obviously happening at that point by some what appears to be supernatural cause?
We don't attempt to answer that question. But in a sense, neither do those who invoke mutations. Mutations are random, and therefore can't be broken down at that level either.
But they're then superintended by natural selection.
What we're trying to do is to infer from the effects back to the nature of the cause. And we don't know, for example, how our minds presently produce the speech that we're using, and this is the mind-body problem in philosophy of mind. But we know that mind is involved. We know something of our own powers as agents are by, if nothing else, introspection. Our own introspective awareness of the powers of our minds makes us aware that minds can do certain sorts of things. We also see the distinctive effects of mind, and can infer from those effects back to the reality of conscious activity. And that's what we're doing, moving from the effect back to the cause. We're not trying to give a complete account of how, if God's mind, which is what Keith and I both believe, how God's mind or spirit moved matter. That may be an unanswerable question, but we can certainly detect that mind was involved based, again, on the uniform and repeated experience that we have, that only minds produce information.
I mean, this information issue, Keith, I mean, do you object in any sense to describing the code of the DNA as information? I mean, or is that a loaded term in itself?
It is a loaded term, but it's one that I think anybody who works with DNA can't avoid using. I use it in my lectures to undergraduates. Mm. DNA is the store of information within the cell. Mm. But in doing that, we're making analogies, and often with, as Stephen said, with things like computers. Mm-hmm. But we then start to push those analogies too far. I mean, DNA is a molecular polymer. A very simple molecular polymer based on four repeating units. So A, G, C, and T is the letters we give them. So there's nothing magical about that in itself.
Let's go to an analogy.
I dispute that because DNA is a molecular polymer. It does have molecular subunits. But it also manifests a property, which in the information sciences we call specified complexity or functional information. It is the precise arrangement of those bases that allow it to perform. This was actually the sequence hypothesis of Francis Crick himself in 1957.
But
that the bases are functioning like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in the machine code. This isn't a mere analogy. Specified complexity is a property of systems. And it's a property of computer codes, it's a property of human languages, it's also a property of DNA. And what we know about the origin of that property is that it always comes from intelligence.
But the word you used in there was the word precise, and how precise is that DNA? We know that there are vast variations that can occur in DNA sequence, and you still suddenly get something that's viable. The sequence of my DNA is different from yours, and it's incredibly different from that of a bacterium. So
it doesn't mean that both sequences have information. I mean, the variation is not the same thing as saying that it's functionless
or
random.
It's not the same as a computer code that either works or it doesn't work. But biology has a whole spectrum of things that work. We don't actually know that the region of space in which that is possible. It could be far vaster than we ever imagine.
Well, there's a measurable degree of specificity, of functional specificity in DNA and protein.
I mean, is it fair as far as... we do use lots of analogies. Stephen was talking about the words printed on the page of his book and the fact that we immediately assume intelligence behind it. Is that the same thing with the DNA code? There's another analogy you draw out in your book about a businessman goes on a flight, lands, Stephen, and has forgotten the mobile number of the person he's supposed to call and thinks, well, if I just put in 0 to 10 and then keep rearranging those, I'll soon enough the right combination will fall out.
I'm making a distinction there between the mathematical conception of information, Shannon information, which does not require specificity of arrangement. It's just a measure of the improbability of a sequence. And the kind of specified arrangements of sequences that we find in codes, languages, and in
because
DNA
when
proteins.
When his business partner rings him with the right number, it's because that has a specified complexity, the right number.
But with the businessman argument, he could probably type in a random 8-digit number and he would get somebody. He might not get the person he wanted, but he would get somebody.
Most likely he'd get no one. And in the case of proteins, it's overwhelmingly likely that he would get no one. This was an important question in molecular biology, which is how rare or common are the functional sequences of amino acids within the space of possible sequences. And one of the reasons that the chance argument has fallen by the wayside within Origin of Life studies is that it has been shown that the ratio of functional sequences to the total number of possible sequences is so small as to make random searches for those functional sequences vastly improbable on cosmic time.
That assumes that we make the whole thing complete de novo, whereas the process of evolution is a step-by-step one. So that we're used to having enzymes that function at phenomenal rates, that they take reactions at millions of fold faster than they would do just left by themselves. We have highly evolved systems where those enzymes are very precise. You can imagine a system where originally even a twofold enhancement in activity would have been significant, and a twofold then is in itself a selection that then gives a tenfold and a hundredfold and a thousandfold. It's a stepwise process this is the fully folded functional protein that we need now. That's what we've got after billions of years of evolution and selection. We look at it at the finished product. We don't know what the starting thing may have been.
We're talking
just
about
an assembly of a couple of amino acids.
These calculations were relevant to determining the probability of finding in the space of possible arrangements even a single functional protein, the first selectable functional threshold. So you can't get to the first selectable functional threshold in a series of gradual steps. That's the one you have to reach by chance alone, and that's where the chance argument has failed. And that's why Origin of Life biochemists have rejected chance
not
as
necessarily,
an explanation.
You're using the word the protein as though we've got a fully functional thing. We have amino acids themselves will bind to nucleotides. So there is some specificity even in the way in which RNA interacts with amino acids.
Well, you're shifting the ground a bit, Keith, because a minute ago you were saying that to get things going, you needed a self-replicating RNA molecule, and that's the concept on the table. But that first initial threshold is itself beyond the reach of chance because of the rarity of functional sequences within what's called combinatorial space. That's got to be searched first before you find something that is functional enough to get the evolutionary process going. And even that first step is vastly beyond what chance can accomplish on a cosmic timescale. I've got a couple chapters on this in the book.
I'm aware of that, and I still think it's the level of the argument says at the moment we don't know. I suspect in 20, 30 years time we will have much better.
What is an appeal to chance but saying we don't know?
Are you confident in that sense, Keith, that we will get to an explanation of the origin of life, which does ultimately boil down to the chance combination of the substituent chemicals, etc.?
I think it's unlikely that we'll ever be certain about that. We're inferring events that happened billions of years ago that may have been a fluke event. Life probably only emerged once.
As a Christian, where does God work into your fluke events?
Well, God will be behind the fluke events.
Design. Then you're with us.
But there's nothing, if you like, irrational or non-scientific about it.
I never said it was irrational or unscientific. In fact, I say just the opposite, that the inference to design is scientific because it is based on uniform and repeated experience, the foundation of all scientific reasoning.
Then I think we're straining at gnats because we're still saying that the basic principle behind the whole thing may have been overseen by God, but we're still using standard chemical and physical properties. That there was nothing miraculous in the sense of unknown chemistry was done. That this worked by all the processes that we know about.
What were those processes then? One of the things I look at in the book is the properties of the constituent parts of the DNA molecule. And since a very important paper by Michael Polanyi in Science in 1968 shown that the forces of attraction, the chemical forces of attraction between the constituents do not account for the sequencing in DNA. I use an illustration of a magnetic chalkboard, the little magnetic letters that stick to a refrigerator, metal board.
We have one at home.
Yeah.
Our six-year-old likes
it. I stole the illustration from my kids when they were small to teach at college. But the metal chalkboard, there's a force of attraction between the magnets in the letters and the metallic chalkboard. But that doesn't explain the arrangement of letters when the kids come, you know, I love daddy, a message. That's produced by mind. And that's something that Polanyi says the information in DNA transcends the physics and chemistry of the DNA. And in the analogy, the information in the metallic chalkboard is coming from an agent. That's what we know.
I mean, this talk of an agent of causality, I mean, is it because science, as far as you're concerned, Keith, just shouldn't have those kinds of inferences in them, that you rule them out sort of a priori in that sense?
To my mind, that's the philosophy of science I'm coming from. Is that science?
That's the essential difference between the two of us.
That a scientist going into the lab doesn't have to infer the existence of a God. That science, by very nature, is exactly the same way that it's done by an atheist. The inference after that, the Christian looking at it, will do exactly the same experiments, give exactly the same results, maybe give exactly the same interpretation, but then say, that shows me the mind of God.
Well, but then this raises the interesting question.
We're not presupposing God either.
Well, I was going to ask, God necessarily presupposed? Because if we're talking about design, you know, it sounds a bit preposterous, but what about alien life seeding that first self-replicating molecule? Now, is that a better hypothesis in that sense, even though it's design, than the chance and necessity of the
That's
first?
An argument of infinite regress, because if the alien life seeded then of course who seeded the alien life? So I think that's an escape
route. I agree with Keith about that. And in fact, I think you have to separate the primary inference from the secondary philosophical deliberations. The primary inference, all we're bringing to bear on this is what we know from experience. This is what science does. And we know that mind, conscious activity, is a reality in the universe, and that conscious activity produces certain kinds of effects that undirected material processes don't produce. And with that, armed with that knowledge, when we encounter one of those effects, in particular information, then we are able to infer back to the activity of an intelligent agent. That raises a second-order question. It's the identity of the intelligence. I happen to be a Christian. Not all advocates of intelligent design are, but I happen to be one. I think the space alien hypothesis is preposterous. Mm-hmm. I think, for example, even scientifically, if you begin to look at the other evidences of design that we have in the universe, the evidence of design built into the very fabric of the universe because of the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry, I think it's possible to make a very strong second-order philosophical case for theism, a theistic design hypothesis, rather than just a brute inference to a designing intelligence of some kind. But just looking at the biology and just based on what we know from are uniform and repeated experience, I think we can infer that a mind has been involved. I think the important difference between Keith's approach and mine is what we presuppose about the rules of science, about the philosophy of science from which we're coming, where we're coming from. I think that science should be open to all of reality, and that we shouldn't say that the best explanation can only be a materialistic or naturalistic cause. I think it also ought to be open to mind, because that's part of what we know from experience. It's part of reality, and it's time to bring that back into our analysis of important events in the history of the universe.
And there I disagree.
So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with some concluding thoughts from both our guests at the end of today's programme, as we've been asking, is there a signature in the cell? So concluding today's programme, we've just got a few more minutes to talk through some of the implications of what we've been hearing about today, discussing whether there's a signature in the cell. Signature in the Cell is the name of Stephen Mayer's book, and a mighty tome it is indeed, running to some, 500-600 pages long. Stephen himself is director of the Centre for the Science and Culture part of the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Keith Fox, Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Southampton, has been interacting with Stephen on the programme today. And we got, gentlemen, really to the point where talking about the origin of life and what counts as an explanation in science, and whether design is valid as an inference, if you like, as an explanation. And we seem to have come to a fundamentally different point of what we each of you will allow. And you've been talking, Stephen, about allowing the whole of reality to have explanatory power, whereas you've been talking about why that's deficient in some sense in science to allow intelligent mind as a sort of causation. Keith, one thing I'd start out with asking then is, earlier on, Stephen referenced the idea of the fine-tuning of the universe as an example, another type of example of intelligent design. And as far as I'm aware, you are willing to see that as a potentially having an aspect of design. Is that the case?
Oh, yes. I don't think that's a knockdown argument, but I think it's a very valid apologetic that's very helpful.
So why is that one allowed in that area
because
of science,
one is based on the... what we know about the fundamental principles at the constants of the universe, and we know that if they were changed by a very tiny amount, that the universe couldn't exist in the way in which we know it, and certainly not a life-giving universe. That's based on, I say, knowledge of fundamental constants.
But we don't know in that sense, like we don't know with the origin of life, how that happened, in the sense that no one's come up with
That's the thing, we don't know. So the intelligent design, and this is parodying of it, it's based on what we don't know. It's not saying that in the same ways the fundamental constants have to be within that narrow window. We're simply saying at the moment we don't have a good explanation. Now, Stephen will argue, all right, that there's information there. I say that the information has come through natural, and there's a loaded word again, processes that we can investigate scientifically.
I have an extensive chapter responding to the claim that intelligent design, the argument that I make, is an argument from ignorance. It's not. It's based on what we know about the structure of the cell, about the information-bearing properties of DNA, RNA, and proteins, the discoveries of the whole information processing system that we found in the cell, and it's based on our knowledge of cause and effect, our knowledge of what it takes to produce information based on uniform and repeated experience. No scientific argument is conclusive in the sense that it settles the issue irrespective of what we may find in the future. But that's true of any scientific inference, not just the inference to intelligent design. So the argument is based on knowledge, not on ignorance. It's not the formal structure of the argument is not an argument from ignorance. We're not saying naturalistic explanations or materialistic explanations have failed, therefore design. No, that's not what we're saying. We're saying naturalistic explanations to this point have not been able to account for the origin of information based on processes that we observe. And yet we know of another process, another causal entity, which is capable of producing intelligence, or which is capable of producing information. That is intelligence. Therefore, based on our current state of knowledge, the inference to intelligence is the best explanation. That's the way science works.
So, Stephen, can I push you then on that? There are a number of science labs who are looking at the origin of life. and chemically and physically how that might have come about, and the origin of the DNA molecule itself, how amino acids assemble into proteins. Are you saying that actually they should shut up shop?
No, we appreciate it. Actually, one of the things that has strengthened the case for intelligent design is precisely the work that people have been doing, even within a materialistic paradigm. There's a problem that I discuss in the book called the displacement problem, where people attempt to explain the origin of information, but in order to account for it, they invariably are inputting information themselves as investigators, the ribozyme engineers, the people trying to get RNA to do the things we would like it to do if, in fact, the RNA world is to be plausible, are themselves demonstrating the need for intelligence because they're having to use intelligence to generate even that limited replicating capacity that I talked about before. So I think those experiments are useful, they're illustrative, they teach us something about nature, and they should continue. But to this point, they haven't shown us anything that suggests that undirected material processes will produce the information required for life.
I'm not sure that's correct.
Because we disagree, but haven't made an argument yet. You haven't pointed to a plausible scenario.
The ribozyme people are looking at one aspect of that. There are others who are looking at how RNA, how the various nucleotides themselves might be synthesized, how those nucleotides might interact with individual amino acids. Rather than each scientist will take it at the level of complexity they're working at. There are many people
working out of a strictly materialistic chemical evolutionary approach come up with an adequate explanation, then so be it. But right now, based on what we know, there is only one causal explanation that can account for information starting from purely physical and chemical antecedents, and that's intelligence. And so that is an inference to the best explanation based on what we presently know, not based on ignorance, but what we presently know.
But I still think it's analogous to the whole thing of say, Newton with his orbits of the planets, of saying that it didn't fit within his equation, so God somehow came in and tinkered
with
that.
Well, the history of that is not quite right to start with, but secondly, that's not what we're doing. We're inferring based on what we know and what we don't know.
Could it be put to you, Keith, that actually there's something going on here, which is that you don't like it either because of your own sort of theological persuasion, which is it doesn't look nice for God to sort of tinker in that sense with one part when the rest of it appears, as far as you can see it, to be explained by material processes that God, yes, is sort of holding up in some sense at an ultimate level, but you don't like this idea that God would interact with these specific
things. Yes, and that if you like, is the interaction between my science and my understanding of theology, is that to say there's some things are intelligent design implies, that may not be what Stephen is implying, but implies that other things are not intelligently designed and they just happen.
Well, there's a break
then between what God does in this world. There's some things that he does and other things that he's not superintending at all, whereas the Christian has the view that God is Lord over the whole process, beginning to end, every moment of every day, every atom, every molecule, every cell, every sparrow that falls, and to say that God is involved in designing the DNA molecule but maybe not involved in other processes, rather narrows down the Christian view of what God does.
As a Christian, I'm not saying that, because theologically there's been long a distinction between what the medievals called the two powers of God, the potentia ordinata, the ordinary power, which is God's, which is manifest in what we call the laws of nature, and the more special power, they sometimes call the potentia absoluta, in which God acts discreetly at particular moments in history that are discernible to us. And the debate about design is essentially a debate about detectability. And what we're saying is that this is the reason for the title. There is a signature of intelligence that makes design detectable in DNA and in the first living cell, that is something very exciting, and is also scientifically tractable in that sense. Can I tell this story that I was promising?
Okay, briefly, yes.
All right, we're in Redmond, Washington, where Microsoft is, and we've had a number of the architect level programmers help us with simulations that we've done of the gene expression system. They write code to help us simulate this in a computer environment. One day, one of these guys comes into my office and he throws down a book on my table. It's called Design Patterns. And he says, I get an eerie feeling that someone figured this out before us. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, design, he explained find that the book Design Patterns, it was a standard manual for software engineers. And he said, as I'm learning about the information processing system in the cell, he said, what I'm recognizing is that the same design patterns, the term of art for design strategies, are being used in processing the information in living systems as we use in modern high-tech digital computing. He said, you go on about the digital code in DNA, and rightly so, but he said, it's far beyond that. There's also, within the code, there is automated error correction. We have a spell check that we use in digital computing. There's a files within folders, folders within superfolders, way of organizing and storing the information. This is all coming out because of the ENCODE project. He said, we use the same kind of hierarchical filing system to organize information. There's a distributive way of storing information and then accessing it and concatenating it on a needs basis to produce a data file that will accomplish a particular function. We use that in computers. It's now what's becoming a clear it's also going on inside the cell. And he went on and on about these very identifiable design strategies that are used in high-tech digital computing but also have been present and at work in the cell itself. Now, these are properties of systems that have one and only one kind of cause. And again, that cause is intelligence. And that makes the activity of intelligence detectable scientifically. Even if we can't answer all the questions about how the designer did it, we can see distinctive ways of solving problems that we know are uniquely associated with intelligence. That makes design detectable. It doesn't deny that other things might be designed or created by God if you're coming from a Christian point of view.
We'll have to leave it there.
Raises an observation in that most of the proponents that I know of intelligent design come from a philosophy or computer background, and there are far fewer who come from molecular biology, biochemistry, genetics.
That's simply false. Look at the editorial board for Biocomplexity. They're members of national academies with qualifications.
I say that's a generalization. That generally is true.
That's not true.
We'll have to agree to disagree on this, but it's been a fascinating discussion, gentlemen. Thank you very much for really digging into these issues great to have you with us today.
You've been listening to a Classic Replay edition of Unbelievable. You're very welcome to get in touch with your thoughts about the show. You can find us at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where there are further resources, the back catalogue of shows, and much more besides. Don't forget as well, if you're interested in Thinking Christianity, you want to be part of our Unbelievable Conference 2022, taking place in London on Saturday the 14th of May. Unbelievable.live to book your ticket, either in person or online. And you can find all of the links that I've mentioned from today with the show notes with today's podcast. For now, thanks for being with us. See you next time.